being, you know. But I understood when he explained it, I understood that it had a lot more teeth. But I also had, shortly after I had him on, I had a couple more radical environmentalists who basically saw it all. They basically confused offsets with cap and trade, I think, but they saw it all as basically being indulgences. So I think that there is a lot of confusion about it, and I wonder, do you argue with yourself about cap and trade, or do you think that it's actually it's a good mechanism?
Well, you know, if and when this bill passes, we're going to need to be really careful about it, and regardless of how an individual group feels about it one way or the other, there are a lot of things that we've sort of been able to learn from in California's circumstances and in other jurisdictions that have considered these similar types of projects.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, April 22nd, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Jesus Christ Superstar. Jesus Christ Superstar is a 1970 rock opera with music by Andrew Lloyd Webber. The story is loosely based on the Gospel's account of the last week of Jesus' life. Again, that's Jesus Christ Superstar showing Monday, April 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It is 6:01, and up next, it's Labor Radio.
Okay, good evening, and welcome to the April 22nd, 2019 edition of Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Amanda Hill, with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Amanda.
We're here with Garen Wales, an activist with the Little Big Union. Welcome, Garen.
Hi.
Okay, following the lead of the first federally recognized fast food union, Burgerville Workers Union, the Little Big Union launched its worker-led campaign on 3/16 of 2019 with a rally and march on the boss, accompanied by over 100 supporters, to present a letter seeking union recognition at Little Big Burger's Northwest 23rd location. Like the Burgerville Workers Union, Little Big Union has chosen to organize with the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. Why the IWW?
Well, I guess the long and short of it is that the IWW has been successful in organizing fast food workers, and they did so locally. Burgerville has obviously been one of our primary inspirations and some of our biggest help in organizing this campaign. You know, as to kind of some of the more, I guess, abstract principles of why we joined the IWW was that, you know, the workers who started this campaign were really excited and empowered by grassroots, you know, grassroots working class mobilization and organization. And that's been, you know, and that excitement has really been a driving factor on this campaign, and one that's allowed it to succeed. IWW campaigns are tough, you know, in a lot of ways. You know, theoretically, sometimes it would be easier to go with a more traditional union, and absolutely not to throw shade on traditional unions in any way, but with the IWW, there's really a capacity for experimentation that you don't have when you exist within, you know, a more kind of like established bureaucratic tradition. And when you have, and it really, it's created a really interesting atmosphere that's allowed us to bring workers kind of from the shop floor to the heart of organizing in a way that's been really exciting and empowering for people.
So what lessons have you learned from the Burgerville Workers Union campaign?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's really too many to list. You know, a lot of the most, I mean, you know, like a lot of, you know, there's, I mean, I think the biggest lesson that we've really come away from is the importance of really owning and establishing ourselves in shop floors and having kind of shop floor organization be the key to the greater organization. And that's something that's been it's hard to establish. It's really something that is, it's a really radical idea for a lot of people, and especially when you're doing so in a way that is, you know, the IWW likes to do things in a more like non-hierarchical way. In a lot of cases, we don't necessarily want to have kind of a lead organizer. That might happen, and, you know, like things, you know, like leaders do arise, but the idea should always be to democratize power and to make it so that everybody on the worksite has access to these levers of working class power and can see how they can work for their benefit. And there's been a lot of workers who have really come to the campaign because they had to, because something had come up at work and they didn't know what to do. And as a result, they came to us, they asked for help, and in a lot of cases, we've been able to provide it in a way that's shown people like, oh, okay, this is, I mean, one thing that we really can't underestimate right now is how much the memory of working class organization has been, on the one hand, how much it has been pushed back successfully, but how much of a resurgence we're on right now of people reaching to these traditions, learning, there's a really interesting old story, I think it's kind of appropriate for Easter, of this young boy who finds this May Day poster. This was written back in like the 1900s, so right before the IWW was founded. And this young boy finds this May Day poster and shows it to this old worker and says, what's this? And he says, this is what people turn to when times get hard. And there's a tendency in life to forget about, you know, what really matters. But people will, when the need is there, like reach for these working class institutions that have been proven to improve people's lives. And I'm sorry, I'm rambling.
Yeah, no problems. You know, the boss truly is the best organizer, as we're seeing in this campaign, as well as the Burgerville Workers Union. So Little Big Burger is a local chain that's kind of gone national because mm-hmm. they got bought out by Chantelier. How many locations are here in the Pacific Northwest?
In the Pacific Northwest, I believe there are, okay, let's see, we've got 2 in Seattle, we've got 10 in the city and 3 in the suburbs, so that's 15.
Okay. And are you trying to organize at all locations?
Right now, we are essentially in the process of reaching out to workers in Seattle. We don't really have, we've been reaching out to the IWW as well, but, you know, we're still figuring out how to step forward there. Right now, we're really focusing on how to organize overall, in the Portland metro area, I believe there's somewhere around 130 workers. I think it's 100 workers in the city, and then maybe another 30 to 45 in the suburbs.
Okay.
So tell us about the kind of work that you and others do on the job. And is this hazardous work?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, kitchen work is dangerous inherently. When you're dealing with sharp objects, a hot grill, there's a lot of unfortunate accidents that can happen. And one thing that's, you know, and it is discouraging to see how little attention gets paid to the fact that this is dangerous work. And that's been something that we've consistently been pushing back on, just getting proper safety equipment for the job. We've had grills that have, we've had grills that have been wobbly at the location I was at. There was, problems with grease pooling in places where you'd scrape it, like you'd have like a tidal wave of grease come up and potentially really hurt you. It is a consistent, one of our first victories was workers at the 23rd location signed a petition so that they could get a slip mat that wouldn't, the slip mats that they had, they were slipping on, which is obviously not what you want from a slip mat, especially when you've got a grill with like a pool of grease in front of you. I figure, in just about any kind of industry, there are going to be health risks, and continuously pushing to make sure that you're getting the best possible protection from whatever kind of injuries is, it's definitely something we've been fighting for.
So it does sound like it's pretty hazardous work. Are your wages and benefits keeping up with the fact that you do such dangerous work?
I mean, we're paid minimum wage. They don't advertise that way. They say that they really hype the fact that you get tips, and actually say they actually advertise the job as if you're get. They say you're getting paid $16 an hour, which is not true. I work at one of the slowest locations in the city, and as a result, I do not see those wages. They really are paying the absolute minimum that they could. And as far as benefits go, I mean, we have to fight to find to get them to give us sick forms. So, that's been, they're really and even what they offered to management in terms of benefits really is incredibly paltry.
Hmm. So with those kind of wages, where do Little Big Burger workers live in this high-priced Portland housing market?
Wherever they can fit, in all honesty. And in a lot of cases, that is further out from the city center, which is where a lot of places are located. Some people are, luckier to find, you can still find little pockets, where a lot of us are very young and live in houses with, eight roommates or something like that. But we are very much of the milieu that works in the center of the city that is slowly being squeezed out. A lot of people being students, they, need to live near their school if they don't want to be commuting incredible distances. And it is a real hardship. I know there's a lot of people on this campaign who have, a third to half of their paycheck eaten every month by rent, which is something that, no one should have to deal with, but is unfortunately a reality. And I'd like to speak a little bit more to this, kind of take this sideways on this point, but they really use the fact that we have tips to basically say that you shouldn't be complaining. And what they're really saying is, well, at least you're not working at Burger Bell. And they're really, they try to, a Little Big Burger kind of presents itself as being like not fast food exactly, as being fast casual. It's very much this cool, hip, sleek branding, and they want their workers to kind of present those values, whatever that means. Let's see how to say. I mean, what it really comes down to is that everybody deserves a union. Everybody deserves a living wage. I remember once watching someone who is aspiring to be a paramedic post a meme saying that, why should fast food workers get $15 an hour when that's the wage that paramedics get? It's like, well, obviously you shouldn't just be getting $15 an hour as well. And that's, what union organization and what the IWW in particular has, with the idea of one big union, the idea has always been that we shouldn't have to step on anybody's neck.
Absolutely.
In order to advance us all. The first real fights in the union movement were between skilled and non-skilled workers. And that's really something that they still try to use against us. It's still one of the most effective ways to convince people that our interests lie with our so-called betters than people that we're taught to hate because they work jobs that we're taught to disrespect.
Exactly. So I saw on your Facebook page that one of your demands is for fair and consistent scheduling. In June of 2018, Oregon Governor Kate Brown signed the Oregon Employee Work Schedule Law into effect. Has this law improved scheduling practices at Little Big Burger? Are they actually following the law? And is the law enough to protect the workers, or do we need to move to unions?
Unfortunately, what we've seen is that Little Big Burger has completely ignored this law. I think they kind of pretend that they're still a small business, and so they say, oh, we have less than 150 employees, so we're exempt from it, but you can't be a small business and
be owned by
a massive corporation at the same time. And so, yeah, we would it would really be wonderful if they would decide to follow the law. You know, there's definitely a push to one location managed to file a petition to get 2 week schedules. They are currently the only place in the company that has those 2 week schedules, and they haven't managed to take them from those workers yet. And I'm guessing that we'll probably see some pushes in that direction if the company doesn't decide to abide by the law. But I think the lesson from that is that I think there's a tendency for American workers to just assume that your boss can kind of do what they want, and not look into your rights. And so this is something to, you know, if you're on the job and there's something that doesn't feel right about what's going on, look into the legality of it. I mean, like, actually ask, can you do this? And if they can't, maybe reach out to a union representative.
So you've talked about some of the actions that you've taken, a petition at one of the stores for slip mats, and somehow you achieved scheduling, compliance with the scheduling law
at one store. Yes.
Can you talk about how that was accomplished, or any other actions that you've taken as a union, and what kinds of results?
That was a result of the scheduling was a result of a petition as well.
Mm-hmm.
The other ways in which we've both of those petitions were also kind of accompanied by a march on the boss. So workers getting together and demonstrating their collective power by saying, hey, this isn't just like one person or just like one person getting around and gathering signatures. We all want to do this together. And that, in one case, they kind of attempted to march on the boss, but then the boss heard about the petition and got really excited about it and signed it too, even though they weren't asked to. And so that's a very particular kind of win, but we'll take it. Our going public action was one of our biggest kind of, it was a celebration and a display of our collective power. And then just recently, Jamie who's interviewing me, was out helping a worker who was recently fired for essentially being involved with the union, which is something I'm sure we'll talk about soon.
And actually, that's our next question.
Yeah,
there we go.
You know, can you tell us a little bit more about what happened with Ava?
Yeah, Ava is an incredibly awesome individual, very outspoken and political, and was a proud union supporter. And we believe that that had everything to do with why she was fired. The circumstances of her firing are curious. She basically broke, she came into work late. She texted that, she slept in. She texted that she would be in soon, and she came in, I believe it was within 2 hours of her shift starting. This is something that has happened multiple times to lots of different people that I know, and we have never seen any kind of punishment on this scale. I know of people who have no call, no showed multiple times in the same month who didn't get fired. And so for Ava, who was recognized as a hard worker, to suffer that kind of punishment after something that happens to everybody, unfortunately. People, sometimes just like...
And Ava doesn't work at the location that's filed for union recognition, though, right?
None of our locations have actually filed for recognition. We're still waiting for the company to voluntarily
to respond. Okay.
Yes.
So, but her location has not filed?
Her location has not filed, and she ended...
Okay, so I'm just... Do you feel this is retaliation on someone at a location that hasn't filed as a threat? They're skirting mm-hmm. the law here just a little, maybe, by targeting
maybe
a location outside of...
Well, maybe you can talk about what actually happened, how the firing happened, talking about intimidation and threat.
They had three of the top managers come in to fire her together, which is... I mean, I have been disciplined before, and that is absolutely obscene and ridiculous. And I'm not even sure what the, and you know, I think it was, in all honesty, it was probably to intimidate the other workers who saw that more.
They did it in front of other workers and customers.
Did they?
That's what I heard.
Oh, I didn't hear that bit.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that seems to be exactly, that seems to be exactly their playbook. And, you know, I think that I know that that location is not one of our strongest spots. And so I think it says a lot that they're trying to pick us off where they think that we're weak, but we will not break. There's a really great, actually, there's a really wonderful quote that I found from a businessman. I'll dig it up for you later, but he's actually like telling other businessmen how to deal with the IWW. And he says, don't pick at it. Don't touch it. It's not something that you can access. It's not a person. It's not a book. It's not an idea. What it is an understanding between people that if you attack will only become stronger.
That is a great quote. I was reading on Chantelier's version of the union coming to Little Big Union Burger, and their response is similar to what Burgerville said at the beginning. We want to give our members a right to either choose a union or not choose a union. It sounds like they're kind of putting some pressure on to not choose the union.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of bad faith that they're operating in is very, people just laugh about it because it's so obvious.
Well, they've hired a union-busting firm, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, their first week was spent basically bending over backwards to, address complaints that we've had. Obviously, you know, the ones that were cheapest and easiest for them were the ones that they went for. And their entire messaging at that point was that they were going to be totally neutral, which was, we didn't really think that they would be neutral. Their hiring of Bullard Law, I'm assuming that people, listeners of this program have heard of them and know how notorious they are for really, really, really just dirty and ugly tactics. But at the same time, their campaign really doesn't seem to have much purchase with any workers that I've encountered, which is, you know, a good thing, obviously. We don't want to tip our hat too much, but we have a strong base of support within the company, and our narrative is one that people find much more compelling than the company.
Can you say a little bit about what their narrative is? I know they sent out some kind of email or something to workers.
No, it's kind of funny because in a lot of ways, I don't want to give them ideas, but a lot of their campaign is a post on attacking us as if we're a much more traditional union, saying that, you know, unions are businesses, and that they're trying to make money off of you. To clarify, we will not be asking for dues until we win a contract at the bargaining table that allows for a raise in wages. So that's absurd.
Restaurant Business Online calls them a quirky little union.
there's a podcast, called The Working Lunch that I heard that was, I guess, Burgerville workers had told me about it. And apparently they, when Burgerville popped up, they were just like, you know, they just kind of made fun of them. They were like laughing about them. After we went public, their tone shifted very dramatically. I think someone actually started reading into what the IWW was and their eyes got really big. That's the thing that makes the IWW interesting is we are, you know, our history is defined by going into locations that are thought to be ununionizable. And, you know, right now I think that they're, especially in a city like Portland where so many people are reliant on the restaurant industry for survival, there is an absolute need for union representation. Especially when you look at restaurant workers are subject to abuse, how precarious the work can be, and, you know, a multitude of factors like that. I mean, there's countries in Finland whose entire fast food industries are unionized, and I really do think that, the techniques of grassroots mobilization that we're utilizing can help this be generalizable, hopefully, to the entire restaurant industry.
This article I was reading also referenced the fact that, you know, the 15 Now campaign that was, you know, largely sponsored by one of our larger unions, it was a failure, and that they needed to really pay attention to this one because it felt so different, because it was the article was basically saying, this is a threat now. We've got to pay attention to it. So it's interesting. To see the other side of it. And I would encourage you to go online and look up what they're telling each other about this.
Well, and to speak to that, I have an old friend, actually, who worked on the 15 Now campaign. The focus became too much on the 15 Now, not enough on the union.
Oh, right.
And I think that's really the thing to focus on, and that we can all agree on, is that really, it's absolutely that, I think in the minds, I mean, we're at a really important point in American political history, because I think for so many people who come at politics from, kind of the liberal perspective that's been cultivated in America has been that change comes from the ballot box and just the ballot box. And obviously the working class fought for the ballot box, so we can't dismiss it. But at the same time, there are certain things that you can't ask for and that, you know, there aren't going to be concessions with. And that is what unionization is for. The only way that the reason that we have this basis in labor law that we can fight from is because people fought and died for it. And we need to, realize that the place that we can reinvent our political imagination very much is at the centers of economic power. And that's what we really need to focus on. And that's why this, this wave of unionization is so exciting and important.
So let's kind of bring it back around to what your campaign has been. So on 316, when you marched on the boss on the 23rd Avenue store, we saw a lot of support with over 100 people in the street marching with you. Who in the community have committed to supporting your efforts, and why is community support important to this campaign?
Wow, I mean, yeah, the outpouring of community support has really been incredibly beautiful, and it's come in a lot of different forms. It's come from everywhere, from people, joining the IWW and helping us out, which is, something I'd encourage everybody to do. Even if you don't think you have anything to contribute to the union movement, I promise you probably do, actually. But we've also seen, a lot of organizations sign on. DSA and DSA Labor has really helped us out a lot. We've received a ton of support from, from tons of unions around town. And received a lot of really great, I really can't emphasize how much this campaign really was a process of, workers teaching themselves how to struggle. And part of teaching ourselves was reaching out to people who had lessons to offer us. And the Portland, a lot of people are going to say that, this is the kind of thing that can only happen in Portland. It can't only happen in Portland, but it's really great having as active and, forward thinking of a labor movement as Portland has, that we could reach out and learn from.
Well, we shouldn't forget Jobs with Justice.
Oh, I know. Jamie.
Amanda and I are
I think that would
with.
Be, of course, it almost goes without saying.
So what are the next steps that you see the Little Big Union taking to achieve your demands?
Well, in a lot of ways, I think the company has unfortunately pointed the way forward by firing Ava in such a kind of obvious act of retaliation. And so we're going to keep fighting for her. And I think that is really going to be, in a lot of ways, we've been wondering what next steps to take. We'll have a lot of others that we're taking, but I think our primary focus right now is going to be on getting Ava rehired and letting them know that they can't just get away with targeting union members, because, this town shows up for the working class. And
so can I guess that you have an escalating campaign in mind?
I don't want to tip our hats too much. I'm not going to say anything that I'm not authorized to say, but we ain't going to back down. I'll put it that way.
Great. So if our listeners want to learn more or get involved in supporting you, how can they connect?
Interacting with us on Facebook, interacting with us on Twitter would be great. Our direct messages are open. We do respond if you want to get involved in some way. You could go to the Portland IWW website, where we have an entire section about onboarding people. You can reach out to the secretary of the Portland IWW if you want to get in touch with a delegate and join. And I guess, yeah, that would probably cover it. You can also email us at littlebigunion.org.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, Garen Wales of the Little Big Union. And you can hear this and other shows archived at www.kboo.fm, so that you know that someone who ought to hear this and missed us tonight can tell them to check it out later. This is Labor Radio, every Monday night from 6 to 6:30. I'm Jamie Partridge, here with my co-host Amanda Hill.
Thanks for joining us, Garen.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks also to our engineer, Mike. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline and come back next week for more Labor Radio.
Spent most of my life in prison.
Criminal records can prevent individuals from moving forward with their lives, particularly with employment and housing. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on April 29th as we discuss how to get your criminal record expunged. That's Prison Pipeline, April 29th at 6:30 p.m.
Now I'm free. Now I'm free.
Presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?